Welcome to the Songs of Note podcast, where we talk about the songs we love and the stories behind them. I'm your host, Ryan Gregg. Hey, this is Ryan. Thank you so much for joining me for the Songs of Note podcast, where we talk about all things music and stories behind songs and kind of just geek out about all good things music. So if you're new, be sure and subscribe so you don't miss future episodes. And then I have something really cool I wanted to share with you. In the formats of, you know, being on a podcast, you are listening to this through a platform. What I am interested in is how can I connect with you in a way that's outside the platform? So like, imagine if Apple shut down podcasts tomorrow, there'd be no way for us to continue to interact in some way. So I would love to give you something, and hopefully in exchange for your email address. And so we can connect in some way. And what do I mean by connect in some way? I mean, I'm planning on sending a newsletter every once in a while. Just, you know, here's some music I've been listening to, or here's a cool thing, or here's a cool video. It'll be something that you can unsubscribe from at any time. And I hope you would think it would be things that are only going to bring you value. And I promise it won't be very often. But in order for you to give me your email address, I want to give you something. So here's what I'm proposing. I made a new episode of the podcast that will be unreleased. The only way that you can hear this podcast episode is by signing up for my newsletter. So that's part one. Part two, the content of the episode is something I think is cool. I went through and looked at, okay, it's not my top songs of all time, because a lot of those were hitting on these podcasts, and we've hit on a lot of them. So I didn't want to just give you a playlist of songs that you already knew, but I made a playlist that I will share with you in a link once you subscribe, and it'll be one where you just click it, and then it brings you up on either Apple Music, and you hit Add to Library, or you click it, and it'll say Add to Spotify, and you say yes, Add to Library. So this is 27 songs that I love, and I love. It's one of my favorite things in the world to be able to recommend music to somebody and them say, man, that song you told me about, oh, so good. If you're listening to this podcast, I bet that's you too, or at least some of you. So this is me saying, okay, these songs are so good. It's all killer and no filler, if you will. And so some of them, you'll have heard some of them. It's not like these are all hidden obscurities. But this is a playlist I've been putting it on all week, just trying to refine it and trim it down and get it to just the ones that I think are absolutely just gems. So that there's 27 songs, and it's almost 2 hours worth of music. And for the bonus episode of the podcast, I went through and talked about, a little bit of the stories behind the songs, a little bit of, several of them. There's personal stories about why I like the songs. If you think that's interesting or not, I hope you do. The whole podcast it's about 30 minutes. So it's not a marathon podcast where I'm going off about every song. But I would hope that you would find value in it. And then also if you sign up, the way you also get a screensaver, a Songs of Note screensaver. So it's all included. The way that you do it, here's how you can get this stuff if you want it. You just go to the website, thesongsofnote.com/bonus. So my website is thesongsofnote.com. And then if you add in the /bonus, if you don't remember how to get there, if you go to my Instagram account, which is just @songsofnote, and you click the link in my bio, it'll say free bonus episode. Or you can just go to thesongsofnote.com and you'll see it in the it should be in the navigation, but the website again is thesongsofnote.com/bonus. You enter in your email address and that'll get you on my newsletter. And then that'll opt you into getting this email from me that will give you the bonus episode, the playlist on Spotify and Apple Music, and a screensaver. So I hope you think it's cool. I thought it'd be some cool way to try to connect with you guys in another way, even outside the podcast. So thank you for hearing me talk about a little bit And I'm super, super excited about today's episode. If you have been on the show before, you know that I try to hit on all kinds of music. I try to do stories about, you know, way back artists like Billie Holiday, current artists, classic rock artists. I just try to hit the stories about bands and songs that I love. And I appreciate you listening and being willing to go on that journey with me. Music is so fun to talk about, and it's fun to be able to experience songs in music in different ways once you know more about the person or more about the story behind certain things. And Janis Joplin is someone who I obviously have known about, and I know, you know, me and Bobby McGee, and I knew the hits. I knew she was from Texas and knew she passed away at 27. But she's a figure that I always just knew was a someone highly respected in the rock world. I knew the hits, but I didn't know really about her personal life and her story. And so I went and found this really great book, and it's called Janis Joplin, Her Life and Music by Holly George Warren. And it just really breathed life into her as a person and as an individual, which when you're trying to read a biography and trying to figure out someone a little bit, I think this book just did a great job at it. Holly did a great job in writing this book and bringing her to life, bringing Janis Joplin to life. So Holly George Warren is the author of this book, as well as 15 other books, including a biography on Gene Autry and Alex Chilton, which is cool. And she's also a Grammy nominated writer, which is totally cool. I loved getting to chat with her about kind of the stories behind Janis and her rise to fame and Jimi Hendrix and Jim Morrison. And there's just, we hit on lots of different Otis Redding, lots of different artists and their interactions with her and their takes on her. So that's the interview we're about to do. She has some really cool things. I'll say the websites here. You can also find them in the show notes, but if you want to get a copy of this book, you can go to goldennotebook.com. Indie Light, that's IndieLite.org, and you can get a signed copy. Or if you even want a personalized signed copy, she'll do that as well. And you can call them, and I'm going to give you the number. The number is 845-679-8000, and she lives near this bookstore. And when she gets requests for people to have a personalized copy, she'll go and sign it and mail it to you. How cool is that? I'm somebody that loves autographs and loves signed books and loves signed anything for musicians and musician related things. So this is something that I thought was especially cool. If you are not already following me on social media, come and follow me. I'm on Instagram at Songs of Note. I'm on Twitter. I'm on Facebook. If you want to send me an email, it's thesongsofnote@gmail.com. Would love to hear from you if you have a song request that you'd like to hear an episode on. Anyway, I've blabbered on and on long enough. Let's head on over to the interview. This is Holly George Warren talking about Janis Joplin. Hey, this is Ryan. I am so excited to be talking with Holly George Warren today. Holly, thank you so much for joining me for the show.
Great to be here, Ryan.
Well, you know what? I love talking with people who love music, and you have obviously done a ton of great work around music and writing about music. And I love that you did an entire book on Janis that I just finished. And so thanks for being willing to chat. And I would love to hear a little bit about, I mean, I can't imagine the amount of work that it's got to take to put together a book and research and interviews. What was the driving thing that made you say, you know what, I'm going to write a book on Janis Joplin? Do you remember, was there a key thing? Moment?
Well, I was very curious about kind of the backstory of how Janis became Janis. You know, how did this young girl growing up in Port Arthur, Texas, get to the point where she was basically the most famous rock and roll singer, I think, in the late 60s? Mm. And I wanted to, you know, kind of trace her journey and understand her evolution as a person, but also as a musician. And I was really excited about that because I thought that she hadn't really gotten her due as far as her musicianship and her chutzpah and her incredible intellect in some of the other books and the way she's just been depicted in pop culture because, you know, sadly we lost her at such a young age. She was only 27 when she died. So it seemed like a lot of the focus had been kind of on her demise and being the self-destructive, et cetera. So I kind of wanted to change the paradigm a little bit.
Well, you know what? That's actually like part of the reason why I read your book, because I knew she was from Texas, which I'm from Texas. And I thought, you know what? I know her songs, but I don't know her whole catalog. And I certainly don't know her story. And I just thought you told her story in such a interesting way that shed light on her background and kind of gave insight into the person who was Janice. So I thought that really came through. You know, one of the things I loved the most about the book was the way that you incorporated things like letters from Janice to her family. How did you get access to those? Was that out for the public, or did you interact with the family directly?
I had the good fortune of meeting Janice's sister Laura and brother Michael over the years at different conferences about Janice and her work at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in Cleveland. Mm. And I knew about the letters because Laura had done a book, kind of a memoir of growing up with Janice as her big sister that came out in the early 90s. And she reproduced some of the letters in that book. So I was eager to read those letters, see them in person. And then I tracked down other letters that Janice had written to various friends and boyfriends, et cetera, which were amazing. She was just such an incredible letter writer. So I was able to get an agreement with the family, not only to allow me to look at all of her personal archives that they have, but also to give me permission to quote from the letters, all the letters that she wrote, since the family oversees the copyright of anything Janice wrote. Mm. So I was really, really fortunate that they trusted me with those incredible things from Janice's own hand.
How cool is that? Man, I love things like that that let you have real insight, you know, into the person. And I feel like that just came through. Her personality seemed to jump out of the words on the letters when she was excited about things and the way that she talked about things to her family.
Yeah, she was so expressive, really, yeah. Really expressive.
Which makes sense with her, even just seeing her on stage personality. It makes sense that in life, I bet she was very much like that.
Yeah, she didn't hold back her feelings and thoughts. And it was cool, too, in that I could read the kind of things that she wrote to her family when she moved out to California in 66 to join Big Brother and the Holding Company, but also even earlier letters that she wrote when she was living back home in Texas after her first stay in San Francisco for several years, trying to make it as a blues singer, a period of her life a lot of people don't understand or even know about, which was really intriguing to me, this very important developmental stage of her life as a musician. And she wrote many of her friends that she met in that period once she was back home in Port Arthur in 1965. So again, you could really see this person coming through the way she wrote the letters to both her family and to her friends.
Well, that, I love that. And, you know, I told you I'm from Dallas, so I'm a Texas guy. So I feel like Texans are able to rightly judge the state. So people in Port Arthur, please don't judge me. But I've been to Port Arthur, where she's from, and it's not my favorite place. It's pretty rough. It's not pretty rough, but it's like, we did some fishing there. It was a rough fishing trip. That's my memory.
Yeah,
on it.
Well, it's really hit some hard times. But, you know, when Janice was actually growing up there, she was born in 1943. So when she was living there, it was a boom town. It was a beautiful city right on the Gulf Coast. It was thriving, of course. It was a real oil town. They had all the oil refineries there, but they had a booming economy in those days. There was even a petroleum parade and Miss Petroleum contest every year. And also, there was a lot of great music that Janice could hear growing up, you know, blues, Cajun, country, and of course, rock and roll. You know, Fats Domino, you know, was from Louisiana, and Port Arthur was so close to Louisiana. A lot of that great music she got to hear as well. And Big Mama Thornton, of course, who cut Hound Dog, not too far away in Houston, was a big favorite record of Janice's after she first discovered it, hearing Elvis doing on the Ed Sullivan Show.
That's so cool. Well, one of the things that stuck out to me and that really bothered me was the story about her classmate in high school, Jimmy Johnson, former Dallas Cowboys coach, who, you know, everyone knows Jimmy Johnson around here. I guess my question is, just how different was Janice in high school from the other kids? How much was her dress sticking out from the other people? And could you tell the Jimmy Johnson story a little bit there?
Yeah, Janice really, marched to her own drummer, as they say. Now, she wasn't always like that. You know, as a young girl in elementary school and even junior high school, she was quite popular and kind of ran around with all the kids. But by the time they got to high school, Janice had, at age 14, discovered Jack Kerouac's great book, On the Road, and became fascinated with the Beats. She also tuned into the civil rights movement and what was happening with the Brown versus the Board of Education, which tried to outlaw segregation. And of course, Port Arthur was a very segregated town, and as you know, most places were in Texas and in the South, even North Carolina, where I grew up. So she didn't like that idea. She opposed that. She was really drawn to music by African Americans. She loved the blues, and she was very outspoken about that. And that was not considered cool to the kind of mainstream kids in high school who just followed what their parents said and traditions, which at that time, you know, was not pretty. Originally she'd been a fan of the football team, but by the time she was, say, in 11th grade, she had turned against that whole kind of idea of school spirit, even though she had been part of the school spirit club before. But Jimmy Johnson and his buddies on the football team did not like that. And also, they went for a certain type of girl who were very passive, very traditionalist, wore the beehive hairdos and all that kind of thing in the 50s. And again, Janice started modeling her look after the Beats and letting her hair hang down and wearing black, you know, turtleneck and tights and all this kind of stuff. And, you know, how high school kids can be quite cruel to anyone who is different. So the other thing about Janice was, as I said, you know, Port Arthur was quite close to Louisiana, where the drinking age was 18 and where you could go to these roadhouses where they didn't even card you. So you could go there and hear live music. And Janice just totally became enamored of that scene and started hanging out with some guys who were into it as well, some musicians and kind of the more free thinking type guys that were in Port Arthur, and would go with them to these places. So she developed a really bad reputation. You know, people started accusing her of being a slut and all this kind of stuff, which she was actually quite innocent in that regard at that time. But Jimmy Johnson was among those guys who were gossiping about her and, you know, saying she was up to no good and she was a slut and all this kind of stuff. And, you know, cop to that later, I found an interview he did for Sports Illustrated from the 90s, and he was still bad-mouthing her, you know.
I can't believe that. Give me a break. Back off, Jimmy. Oh, that just bothered me so bad. I was like, man, you're representing the state poorly.
I would not say he was a feminist.
that sounds accurate. Well, for people that don't know, I mean, I love being able to just ask questions that obviously you've told in the book, but to let people like kind of get a little insight into it. How did she get hooked up with Big Brother in the first place? The band, you were kind of talking about them a little bit earlier.
Yeah, well, as I mentioned, she went to college in Beaumont to Lamar, and then she dropped out, and then she went out to California for a little while, and then she came back and went back to Lamar. Then she finally ended up in Austin at UT in 1962. There she, you know, met up with some musicians, and she actually started performing music live for the first time ever. Believe it or not, she was quite shy leading up to that. And among the people that became her fans was a guy named Chet Helms, also a Texan, who had dropped out of UT, and he was into Kerouac also and hitchhiking around doing his on-the-road thing. And so they actually hitched together for the first time to San Francisco in 1963. And that's when Janice first tried to make it as a blues singer ran into some issues with drinking too much, doing too much speed, et cetera, and finally ended up back in Texas. Well, in the meantime, Chet stayed on out there in San Francisco, ended up being a major mover shaker of this new countercultural scene that was developing called the Family Dog was part of it. And they started putting on these psychedelic dances in these old ballrooms. And he began managing Big Brother and the Holding Company, a band that started around 65. And some of the other bands started having female singers like Jefferson Airplane, et cetera, Grace Slick. And they thought, we need a girl singer. So he's like, I know, just the girl. So he literally sent word back to Texas. And at this point, Janice was doing shows again in Austin, singing mostly accompanying herself an acoustic guitar, and said, hey, you got to come out here, check out the scene, and try out for this band, Big Brother. So in June of 66, that's what she did. Another Texan, Travis Rivers, drove from San Francisco to Texas, picked her up, and she rode back with him. And, of course, it was just this love fest when she went in and started singing with the band in their rehearsal space in June of 66. And she never looked back after that.
It seemed to me, and correct me if you think differently, but it seemed to me that Big Brother and the Holding Company was a necessary evil in the fact that they made great music together, and maybe she wouldn't have become the star she became without them, but at some point she surpassed them in skill and talent, and they end up being something that was holding her down, it seemed like, by the end. But maybe she wouldn't have gotten to the level that she did with the opportunities that she had it not been for them. Do you think, did Big Brother and the Holding Company help her or hurt her in retrospect?
Oh, they definitely helped her. I mean, they were a crucial part of her development, becoming the singer and the performer that she was. She had never even played with a band with drums or electric guitars before. So she really had to change her way of singing, you know, and she had already done that. You know, she sang in the church choir and the glee club when she was a little girl growing up with this real pretty soprano. And then she changed her voice to sound bluesy, et cetera, when she started doing the blues music. And then when she started playing with Big Brother, she had to really, really belt it out. And they already had quite a bit of a following in the San Francisco area even before she joined. So she immediately got some fans. And, of course, people were just riveted by her style. And they gave her a lot of confidence. They, you know, in the beginning, she was just singing a few songs. But, of course, pretty soon the spotlight was on Janice. And, sadly, by June of 67, they, you know, had their big breakthrough performance at Monterey Pop.
Yeah.
And, you know, everybody was talking about Janice. And this was the same concert, you know, where Jimi Hendrix and The Who and Otis Redding, all these great performers. But Janice was one of the major, no one had heard of her when she performed there, but afterwards everybody had heard because the press was just going nuts over her. So that did lead to some problems within the band. And the thing is, I think Janice was such a restless soul artistically that even if they hadn't run into those problems, even if she hadn't been the uber talent and these guys were on a different level, she probably would have left because she loved to try different things musically. She was so in love with soul music. She wanted to have a horn section.
Right.
She wanted to have a B3 organ. She loved the sound that Aretha had, that other, you know, singers backed by that kind of instrumentation. She loved Otis Redding.
Yeah.
So she wanted to try that, and that was not in Big Brother's wheelhouse whatsoever.
Was it the Monterey Pop Festival where you told the story about all the musicians getting together underneath the stage backstage and Jimi Hendrix and her were having a jam session and Phil Graham comes in and goes, shut up, they can hear you out there. Is that right?
Yeah, can you imagine to have been a fly on the wall with that? Oh, my God. And then after that, Big Brother got to do a gig with Jimi Hendrix at the Fillmore in San Francisco. And she and Hendrix, you know, were quite tight, you know, and then horribly, just a few years later, he died in September of 1970, and she died like 2 weeks later. It's really weird.
It is weird. Well, and you know, I wouldn't group Hendrix into a wild characterization like I would like someone like Jim Morrison. But it seemed like Janice was drawn to people like Jim Morrison in some way. But it also seemed like she had a completely different side where you in some of those letters where she's saying, "Mom, send me my knitting stuff," or she's talking about like cooking and it just seems like she had very different, it seems like she had a rock and roll persona and it seemed like she had a back home type persona. Am I saying that in a weird way?
Yeah,
or do you agree?
Yeah, totally. Totally. She was very complicated. And even up until just a few months before her death, I mean, she was talking about wanting to settle down and get married. She had bought a house in Larkspur in Marin County and, you know, took a little time off and was fixing it all up. And in fact, people that knew her said that, you know, even though she was on the road all the time, she'd always kind of decorate her hotel room and give it a certain charm. And she did love to cook. I got to meet an interview of this, I think the one guy who really truly loved her for herself, this very cool guy named David Niehaus, who actually lives just down the road from Willie Nelson in Hawaii, when
wow.
Willie's in Hawaii, yeah. And he told me all about she would love to cook for him and, you know, cook burritos and cook him a steak dinner and all this kind of stuff, and, you know, was quite different from her stage persona.
Well, I love that. And I think that adds an element to her, like you said, persona that people don't know. Like, I would have never guessed that based on when you just hear her singing, you're like, man, she's brash and has an amazing voice and seems, man, full throttle. But then to hear that, like, that makes her, like you said,
yeah,
even more complex character.
Yeah, and sadly, she, you know, she didn't live long enough to actually get to the point where maybe she could take a little break and settle down, have a kid or whatever. I mean,
yeah,
it's, you know, she loved animals. You could really see her maternal side also in the way she, you know, had this dog named George that, you know, she would take everywhere with her, and she just was crazy about him. And she, you know, always had dogs and cats, and she, you know, she was a very loving person in that side of her. And the same thing with, you know, her roommates that she lived with talked about how, you know, she was really kept a clean house and always would balance her checkbook. And, you know, there's this other kind of very down-to-earth side you would never think about.
Well, somebody else you brought up a minute ago is Otis Redding. And, you know, if for anyone who is listening, if you can watch his entire performance at the Monterey Pop Festival. And it's incredible. I mean, it's still incredible. And that happened in 1967?
Yeah, that was June of 67, yeah.
Like, there is fire coming off. I mean, it's just incredible. So I can't imagine the influence that someone like that must have had over her to be coming up with these songs in real time, and her being so close to him. How much of an influence do you think he had onto her?
A large influence. In fact, she got to see him for the first time in December of 66 because Bill Graham brought him in to perform at the Fillmore. And he did three shows, and Janis went early every time, every night, so she could get a good spot and watch him. And I talked to people who actually remember watching her watch him, and she was just soaking him up like a sponge. And literally you can see or hear, you know, I've got bootlegs of some songs that, you know, that was in the, that were in their repertoire before Otis, and then the same songs after. And she started kind of incorporating some of the kind of way he would sing and like do that kind of stuttery thing with like certain, you know, words and things like that.
Yeah.
And she started doing that. And then also, I think he was a very powerful performer, very sensual on stage, and I think she picked that up, too, and started using some of his kind of mannerisms. And, you know, of course, she would Janicize everything and kind of do it her own way, but I think he hugely inspired her, and she would still talk about him for, you know, up until the, you know, end of her life about what a huge influence he was. And horribly, you know, he died not long after Monterey Pop in a tragic plane crash.
Right.
So, you know.
Well, I wonder if one of the stories I loved was the Me and Bobby McGee story about how that song kind of came to be, and how that I actually didn't remember that was a Chris Christopherson song. Could you kind of tell the story about how she got that song and kind of claimed it as her own, it seemed like, by the end?
Right? Yeah. Well, even Chris has said, you know, I got to interview him a few times over the years, and he said that, you know, he thought of it as Janis's song now because she just, her interpretation really defined that song. But interestingly enough, she learned the song from this very cool guy named Bobby Neuwirth, who had been Dylan's aide-de-camp back like in the mid-60s and filled the same role for Janis on her tours. And he worked for Albert Grossman, Janis's manager, a very famous manager who also had managed Dylan. And one day he heard the song being sung by Gordon Lightfoot in Grossman's office. And Bobby Neuwirth was like, oh my gosh, I got to learn the song. Janis is going to go nuts over this song. And Janis was in New York at the time at the Chelsea Hotel. And so Neuwirth learned it, ran over to, was meeting her for dinner that night, taught her the song. She went nuts over it, learned how to play it on an acoustic guitar. And this is 1969. And she still had her second band, the Cosmic Blues Band with the horn section and all that. So she literally did that song for the first time in Nashville and said, y'all never heard of this guy, but he's going to be big. Trust me, you know, and did the song. And finally, she met him in 1970 when Neuwirth had finally met him in New York and said, we got to go visit Janis. And they hopped on a plane. Those were the days we could take a bottle of tequila on a plane with you. So they just showed up at Janis's doorstep, you know, at her house in Marin County, and they completely clicked. And Janis was crazy about his songwriting. She also learned his song Sunday Morning Coming Down, you know, which was made famous by Johnny Cash, recorded that, and just loved his music. And she and Kristofferson got quite tight in more ways than one. Mm. And I think she, you know, if she had lived, she probably would have done a whole album of Kris Kristofferson songs. Oh, or maybe she'd started writing some herself because, you know, he's a guy from Brownsville, Texas, but he had the poetry and the songwriting chops of like a Bob Dylan, who was a big idol of Janis's. So I think she just really admired his artistry and did such a great job with that song. And, of course, that became a posthumous number one. She ended up recording it for Pearl, and it became a number one hit for her after her death.
Which, if I remember right, Otis Redding's Sitting on the Dock of the Bay was the first song for a posthumous artist, and then hers was the second one, if I remember right, going into
You know your trivia. Crazy. Yeah, it's pretty wild, huh?
Yes. Well, so here's a question. This is more just your opinion on it, but like when you look at Janis and you see her life and you see, you know, the way she would get into things like drugs and alcohol, and then she was fighting it to pull away from it. It seemed like it was a push and pull. What do you think? How do you think she viewed her own self-worth? I feel like she was always trying to reach out or to prove herself to her parents in the letters, at least. Mm-hmm. And it seemed like maybe she would go to those things to cope with the stress of all that pressure. I don't know. I wonder, was she somebody with low self-esteem that she was trying to prove herself her whole life?
Probably so. It's hard to really analyze these things, but I think that she also was very ambitious and always pushing herself and always wanting to be a better singer, a better artist, a better daughter, a better, you know, whatever. And, you know, it was hard for her to live up to her own expectations. Mm. And then early on, I mean, just part of the culture too, with the whole drugs and alcohol thing, I think, you know, how teenagers go through this horrible period of, you know, feeling like outsiders or, you know, not feeling confident at all. And I think that's when she first discovered alcohol, you know, when she was a teenager. And like I said, she was quite, you know, shy about singing in front of people. So she started having a few nips before going on stage in 62 in Austin. And, you know, she realized, wow, you know, I can do whatever.
Courage. Huh?
Exactly. Yeah. And then she did have that kind of personality, or maybe it was a body chemistry thing, but, you know, she got addicted to crystal meth when she was living in San Francisco in 63, 64, 65. And then, you know, horribly, she got addicted to heroin. And some of it, too, was, I think, with the heroin, first off, you know, they love, she and her bandmates and Big Brother love jazz musicians, and they loved, you know, the fact that these people were such incredible artists, and then they saw their connection with heroin, like Billie Holiday, Charlie Parker, John Coltrane were their big idols. So they're like, oh, well, let's do it, you know, and then without really realizing how horribly they would get addicted. And, you know, they were in their early 20s and just, you know, it snuck up on them. Unfortunately, I think even though Janice was able to stop doing heroin, she never really stopped drinking that much. I mean, she's kind of cut way back and stopped for a while at 65, but I think that was probably her, you know, biggest addiction was to alcohol.
Well, you know, something that you know, because you've studied rock extensively, and it's interesting when you look at people who pass away early. You know, there's been so many people that died at 27, and there's been so many great musicians who die early. And so much of the question is, oh, there's so much they could have done, which so much of the surrounding, you know, whatever around the person is, there's so much that we missed from them, which may or may not be true. But in cases where the artist was great, I think it certainly makes sense to assume that it would be true. What do you think we missed out on from her? What kind of future work do you think she would have done? You mentioned maybe a Kristofferson album. What else do you think she would have done?
Oh, gosh. Well, she was such a passionate student of music, and she really studied other artists who inspired her. She loved Nina Simone. Hmm. She was actually taking piano lessons the last year of her life. So, you know, I suspect she might have even ended up doing kind of a Nina Simone-inspired, you know, record playing piano.
Yeah.
And the cool thing about her that I didn't realize until I did research for the book was, even though she was this amazing live performer, she was equally very, very good in the studio, which is a total other side of the brain.
Yeah.
And she loved that whole technical part of recording and had the patience to just sit there for all the mixing sessions. And she was really learning her way around the studio. And she so impressed her final producer, Paul Rothchild, who was a kind of take-no-prisoners kind of guy.
Big
I mean,
name.
He would make Jim Morrison redo vocals like 10 or 12 times.
Right.
And I got to hear the tapes of them just talking in the studio between takes. And she's like coming up with all these ideas, like, wait, let's slow down the tempo. Wait, no, let's put a guitar part here. I mean, she's basically doing the job of a producer. And Rothchild is going along with what she has to say. And, you know, he told her road manager, John Cook, oh, you know, Janice has got the makings of a great producer. And Janice, I think, would have gone on to become a producer, and this was a period when even the guys didn't get to produce their own stuff. You know, it was like left to the producers, not the musicians, not the artists, and no women got to do that. And I think Janice probably would have been one of the first ones, so who knows what she would have done. It's really tragic that we didn't get to find out.
What do you think, when do you think, like, the genius of her singing really came to like a public acknowledgement? Like, do you think it was immediate as soon as she came out, people were like, oh man, what a singer? Or was it after she died and people more started to reflect on her work? Like, is there a certain tipping point where you think, okay, at this point she was seen as this level of artist? Does that make sense?
Yeah, definitely. I would say the Monterey Pop film, when came, you know, that came out in 68, that was directed by the great D.A. Pennebaker. And she did this, you know, heart-stopping version of Ball and Chain, which was written by Big Mama Thornton, who, you know, she'd already loved from her teen years. And people just were, you know, literally, if you watch the Monterey Pop movie, you'll see a close-up shot of Mama Cass from, you know, the Mamas and the Papas' face just going like, wow.
Yes,
you know, people are just literally gobsmacked, as they say.
Yeah.
And and also at that time, not many women were so expressive and passionate on stage the way Janice was. And I think so the combination of her vocal chops and then her incredible performance style really attracted a lot of attention in 1967. And she was this journalist dream, in that she was a great interview. She was super smart. She'd come up with all these great little quips and mm-hmm. things, you know. So she got lots and lots and lots of media attention. And also, she was incredibly visual and artistic, so she did amazing photo shoots with photographers. Mm. So there was incredible images of her as well. So I think all of these just kind of made her this perfect kind of media star, and people recognized that her voice was really unique mm-hmm. and really powerful, you know, right from the get-go.
That's cool. And that's cool to make the connection between to the movie, the Monterey Pop Festival movie as well. Is there one thing about Janice that sticks out to you that would surprise people that most people wouldn't know?
I think we talked about some of those surprising things, just that there was this very domestic side to her that, you know, did want that, you know, in the 50s, the kind of the goal of settling down, having the house with the white picket fence. And she definitely did have that as part of her personality. And then also the fact that she was so talented in the studio as well, and was on her way to becoming a producer. She was also quite the bookworm. She always had a book with her. She was mm-hmm. reading. She'd write letters about what book she was reading. And again, you know, she came up with this incredible persona, as we talked about, as this wild woman, blues mama, you know, that was just partying all the time. But she definitely had that kind of quiet intellectual side, too, that she did not make, the public aware of. She tried to hide that. In fact, there's this one segment of her on the Dick Cavett show. She was on that show quite a few times. Mm-hmm. And he was going like, what do you, and they'd probably been talking about books before the show, because he says like, oh, do you ever have time to read? She's like, oh, well, hardly ever. I mean, maybe once in a while I can glance at a book on an airplane. But in reality, she had her friend Linda make her this special cool beaded bag that would hold both a hardcover book and a bottle of booze. So that was another thing about her that, you know, I was reading some of the books that she read just to kind of get into her head.
Yeah. Interesting, man. That's a great story. I didn't know that. All right. Last question. People may know the greatest hits. They may know, you know, the Me and Bobby McGee's songs like that. Are there any deep cuts or rare songs that are some of your favorites that come to mind, even one or two?
Yeah, definitely. I think her first solo album without Big Brother has been, it never really got its due. And I think there was a backlash against her by, you know, the boys club of, rock journalists of the day that held it against her that she would quit her band and become a solo artist.
Yeah.
But that album is called I Got Them Old Cosmic Blues Again, Mama, is amazing. Hmm. It's such a great record. And this one song that she wrote called Cosmic Blues really is fantastic. Her version of Little Girl Blue that's on there is amazing. I mean, the whole record is really, really good. And if you want to have your mind blown, go to YouTube and do a search on Janis Joplin and Tom Jones and see them together on his TV show doing Raise Your Hand, which was also on that record, which is phenomenal. It's incredible to see them singing that song together and dancing around, and it's not lip synced. And then she also does another song on that show too that's really good. So check that out.
I love it. Okay, well, for people listening, I'm going to look up those YouTube links and I'll try to put them in the show notes so people can check them out. Holly, thank you so much for your time today. It's just been a real pleasure getting to hear about your thoughts on Janice, and I loved your book. And for people listening, you can also find the link to get that book and get a signed copy in the show notes. Thank you so much, Holly.
Okay, well, thanks for having me. As you can tell, I love talking about Janice.
Yes, she's a lot of fun.
Thank you for listening to the Songs of Note podcast. Be sure and subscribe so you don't miss an episode. See you next time.